This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
Our guest today is Justin Rose, who is a partner and managing director in the Boston Consulting Group's Chicago office. Justin leads the operations and digital clients practice for BCG's industrial clients globally. Justin, thank you so much for speaking with Knowledge at Wharton today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
So we wanted to talk with you about the future of U.S. manufacturing. And before we do that, I wonder if we could start by talking a little bit about your own background and how you got interested in American manufacturing and its future.
Of course. Growing up, I was always interested in big issues, geopolitics, energy, environment. And during my time at BCG, I was lucky enough to work with a major solar panel manufacturer, which was more or less my dream assignment. During the work, I got exposed to their manufacturing assets, and I was blown away at the intricacy and sophistication. You know, a lot of people think about manufacturing as hard, dirty labor, but what I saw was really intricate, sophisticated operations. And I realized that for many things in the world that I wanted to happen, products had to be made to enable it. And that really intrigued me.
So now, there's, when you talk about manufacturing, there's been a kind of conventional view that manufacturing in the U.S. has been in long-term decline and that competitive advantage in this industry has moved to countries like Mexico and China. Now, I wonder, from where you stand, do you think that perspective is still valid or is it out of date and why?
It's a great question. It's, in some ways, it's both valid and outdated. And so it's valid in the sense that many basic and low value add products have moved outside of the U.S. It's outdated in the sense that the U.S. still has an incredibly thriving manufacturing sector. There's over $4 trillion in annual output. And in aggregate, we produce the vast majority of what we consume in the United States. What's changed is our focus is different. We win in innovative products that require engineering and sophistication. And while that transition has been really painful in many parts of the country, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We just need to make sure we support our workers so they can continue to support their families and communities.
And since you look at what's happening in manufacturing from a global lens, how are the changing cost structures in altering the map of global manufacturing?
For the last 30 years, people have talked about the globalization of supply chains. And my belief is that in the next 30, we're going to see that unwind. There's really three reasons. So first, costs are evening out globally. In 2004 in, say, China, they were about 15% cheaper on average from a manufacturing cost standpoint than the United States. The average wage for a manufacturing laborer was under a dollar an hour. There weren't any real safety or environmental standards to speak of. But that's changed. Now China is only about 5% cheaper. And that doesn't include the extra cost of shipping goods across the Pacific to U.S. consumers. Second, there's clearly trade tensions and an intentional reordering from, quote, free trade to something that we refer to as managed trade. And so you see things like Brexit having an impact, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, USMCA, and so on. And all those things are creating real frictions in the global supply chain in the immediate term. And probably most interesting is the forward-looking perspective. And that's all about technology. So many of the listeners have probably heard of Industry 4.0 or advanced manufacturing. And without going into all the details, it's mostly a set of technologies that allow labor to get removed from manufacturing processes. And so if a country, and let's use China again, has labor that's 50% cheaper in a product where 20% of the cost is labor, that means they would have a 10% cost advantage overall. But if that percentage of labor falls from 20% to 10%, because of automation and other advanced manufacturing technologies, that advantage cuts in half. Now, our view of BCG is that 60% or more of the tasks in a factory can be potentially automated, and therefore, over the long term, the advantage from being a low-cost country starts to go away. Now, if I take a step back, what does that all mean? It means we move from global supply chains to regional ones. There's still a role for lower-cost manufacturing, but that will be served more by nearshore countries, Mexico for the United States, Eastern Europe or North Africa for Europe. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty dramatic shift, a real unwinding of the last 30 years of international order.
That's really interesting, Justin. So what are the implications of these changing cost structures for U.S. manufacturers?
You know, in general, it's good news. The Western Hemisphere in general and North America in particular is an enormous trading bloc, and U.S. manufacturers should have an opportunity to win more business there while continuing to compete on the global stage for high-tech and highly engineered products. But it's important to remember it's not a given. Just because of these longer-term trends, U.S. manufacturers can't lose focus on deploying and integrating technology and re-engineering processes to drive productivity gains. And that's a place that we've seen a lot of slippage in the United States in the last 10 years that needs to really be re-energized.
One thing that I keep hearing, especially when people talk about manufacturing in China becoming more expensive, is that the competitive advantage may not necessarily shift back to the U.S., but elsewhere in Asia. So people talk about Vietnam, or increasingly people also talk about India. As you know, Narendra Modi had launched this program called Make in India. And I was wondering, do you think these initiatives like Make in India and the ascent of manufacturing in other parts of Asia, these initiatives have a chance of succeeding?
Great question. You know, first, a word on China. You know, a lot of people say China is becoming relatively more expensive and therefore manufacturing is going to shrink there. And I don't believe that's true at all. The fact that they're getting more expensive does not spell doom for them. The Chinese consumer market, is, as you know, is mushrooming. And in a world of regionalizing supply chains, I see Chinese manufacturing simply reorienting to make more of what they would have historically exported for their own Chinese consumers. Now, in terms of other countries like India, as you said, Vietnam, you mentioned Thailand's another, there's absolutely a great deal of opportunity for them. I see real progress in all of those countries, and my clients are increasingly considering sourcing from them for basic parts, metal castings, some, you know, engineered products as real credible sourcing solutions. But there's real structural issues there. So several years back, I took a look at Vietnam, and it turns out they only had 1/20th of the port capacity of China. And so realistically, how much manufacturing could overnight, or even in the short term, pick up and move from China to Vietnam? In India, there's documented cases where it's taken longer for goods to get from the center of the country to the port in Mumbai than it has for that ship to sail from the Mumbai port to the United States. And so they're working on those things. There's big infrastructure pushes across Southeast Asia and South Asia. But they'll take a long time and a lot of investment for them to solve and become a real plausible replacement for the volume of manufacturing that happens in China.
Understood. Now, coming back to the U.S. and reading some of the things you've written, you say that the U.S. needs a more aggressive approach to developing and adopting robotic technologies. Now, why do you think this is important for U.S. manufacturers?
Yeah, I don't just think it's important. I think it's critical. It can be intimidating to drive technology into the workplace. You know, jobs go away or change and humans feel left behind. But if we want to keep up as a manufacturing powerhouse, I truly see this as the only choice. And the U.S. needs to lead here. It's not enough to just let it happen naturally over time. When we look at what other countries are doing, Germany, Japan, and of course China, they're actively driving advanced manufacturing technologies into their supply bases, into their OEMs. And I think the U.S. needs to actively promote this as well.
But does the U.S. have enough skilled workers who know how to work with these innovative manufacturing technologies? How serious is the skills gap, and what should be done about it?
Yeah, so we researched this several years ago, and it's funny in a way. Part of what we did, we pulled headlines from Germany, from China, from Japan, newspapers and blogs and magazines, and they all say, there's a crisis, we don't have enough skilled workers. And so, yes, it's clear that there are skills gaps in the United States and that this will be a huge challenge and a growing challenge going forward. The more interesting question is whether it's a relative disadvantage to others or not, and I'm less sure on this. Now, nevertheless, we need action here too, especially as we think about what we just covered and the impact of technology that's staring us in the face. Government and academic institutions have a role, and they need to lean into that. But I think more than ever, companies do as well. And so for a long time, you know, I would say companies have treated the manufacturing workers as disposable in a sense. They come out of a training program, they stay for a bit, they move on. And this has got to change. Workers, especially in a highly skilled manufacturing world, are a true competitive asset for a company. And so what does that mean? You know, in my view, companies need to own the problem and they need to start to build tools to grow their own experts, rotate them as they would executive teams to keep them engaged, retrain them when their job changes, and not rely on, you know, federal or local government assistance or community college programs and so on. And the companies that do this well and really lean in there, I think are going to have a huge advantage because they're going to have a workforce that is energized, loyal, and capable, and everyone else is going to be struggling around trying to pick up people on the margins.
Is that what you mean by the relative disadvantage of the other countries?
Precisely.
Understood. So if you look at, you know, the companies in the U.S. that are well-positioned for the future in terms of manufacturing, maybe you could give us two or three examples of such companies, what they have done differently and what other manufacturers could learn from their experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you three examples, actually. I'm going to give you two that are manufacturers and one that's a retailer because I think it's a quite interesting story there as well.
Sure.
The first manufacturer, I would say, is John Deere. So they are making really impressive efforts to integrate technology both into their products but also into their processes. They're building the workforce in a lot of rural areas where people would typically say, you know, it's been hollowed out by past economic downturns and perhaps the, you know, the skills don't exist. And they're deploying technology into their plants that's really cutting edge. They're taking a long-term view, and they're making smart investments. It's not that they're, you know, re-engineering every factory wholesale today, but they know what the roadmap is and the game plan is for the next 5 and 10 years. Another one that's similar to that is Ford. So they, in addition to some of the things that Deere is doing, you know, they have a really entrepreneurial culture at the plant level. And so they have plant managers and supervisors that are trying by themselves, experimenting with new technologies, you know, 3D printing or additive manufacturing for different parts or components or for tooling. And then they have a coordination overlay staffed by a very senior gentleman who is actually in charge of testing many of the cutting-edge technologies, sorting out what the roadmap for deployment looks like, and managing the innovation campus and activities they have dedicated to this. Now, I said I wanted to add a retailer, and that retailer is Walmart. So Walmart's been very public, as you probably know, over the last several years about increasingly sourcing product from the United States. And, of course, they're not manufacturing themselves. But with their size and scale, what they're doing is going through their supply chain, and they're understanding in detail things like what would the relative cost be for many different potential sourcing locations? And beyond that, where are there gaps in the supply chain? So if I want to manufacture bikes in the United States, do I have tire manufacturing capabilities? Can I make the gearbox? Can I make the pedals? And where they find gaps, because one gap can keep the whole supply chain from moving back in some cases, they're encouraging suppliers to come back and giving them promises of volume commitments to actually start to move entire supply chains back. I just find that very thoughtful and very disciplined, and it's something that I think others could learn from and something that would really benefit U.S. manufacturing broadly.
No, that's really interesting. So thanks for those examples. In thinking about U.S. manufacturing historically, it seems to me that America's lead was often driven by its lead in innovation and R&D. Do you think the world, U.S. still leads the world in research and to emerging technologies? So has that competitive advantage moved to other countries like, say, China, for example?
It's a great question. So the U.S., still lead the world in R&D by some distance. But you have to unpack it to really see what's going on and to see where there's risk involved. And so the way I think about it is breaking it into three categories. So there's basic research. So this is things like studying how the universe was formed. It's the purpose is to build, you know, the foundational scientific knowledge without any real focus on a product or a process. The U.S. has always led there, continues to lead there by a wide margin, and that's hugely valuable work because that sets the foundation for almost everything that comes after it. The second step is applied research. And so this is science that's more focused on addressing a particular need, so trying to solve a practical problem, finding a cure for a disease, boosting agricultural production, improving energy efficiency. And the U.S. continues to do well there as well. But the real gap the emerging gap is on the third, which is developmental research. So that's taking the knowledge that was established in the first two steps and turning it into materials, devices, systems, or processes or methods specifically. So it's about how do I increase processing speed on a chip, that type of thing. And that's a place where if I look at where the U.S. Has invested versus where China has invested, China has invested very heavily on that downstream developmental research. And of course, that downstream developmental research links very closely to creating products and to reengineering manufacturing processes and ultimately to selling goods. And so I think the U.S. needs to consider how they are going to balance the R&D overall between those three buckets and amp up some of the developmental research to help support U.S. manufacturers and U.S. manufacturing interests.
So does that mean that the U.S. needs to become better at execution along the third dimension that you mentioned? And how can the U.S. do that?
Yeah, absolutely right. And there's very much a lack of coordination. It's almost startling. And it's born of, you know, the entrepreneurial culture that is the U.S. and the many different institutions that participate in this. Many times you'll find there are upstream research in basic and applied areas that, you know, downstream companies that might monetize have no idea about, no access to, et cetera. There's no process to systematically focus on the important topics and move it through that funnel, if you will, down to things that we can use to sell or integrate into our processes. And so I think there's a real lack of coordination there. And there's a real need to actually continue to drive that more effectively.
Going back to what you said about basic research, where the U.S. has such a lead, what do you think are some of the most promising areas of basic research that could lead to manufacturing breakthroughs in the future?
Yeah, you know, I'm obviously not a scientist or a researcher, so it's always dangerous for me to hazard guesses on these things. But I would suggest a starting point might be to look at a group of people that have examined this very closely. And again, that's our friends in China. And the good news is that they make their intent very clear in their five-year plans. And I would encourage people to, you know, read the current one, look back at the last few, and they're focusing on areas like green energy, like biotech, like AI, and how that will, you know, drive and transform supply chains and manufacturing processes. And those feel like pretty good calls to me. And perhaps a place that we should be further examining and maybe a place that we should be starting.
And one last question. If you were to, you know, look at American manufacturing 5 or 10 years from now, what do you think it would look like? And what should be the top priorities for U.S. manufacturers to get ready for that future?
I have a lot of hope for American manufacturing. I think that there are some real tailwinds that we laid out around the long-term evening out of costs, the future-looking availability of technology to help us stay competitive. And so I think there's a lot of hope, not just for large companies, but for small and medium-sized enterprises as well. Where I think we need to focus is the following. The U.S. has always been very reluctant to create a coordinated industrial policy. We're very reluctant to, quote-unquote, pick winners. And I think that's something that's going to increasingly hamper us as you have to invest at a greater scale to find the breakthroughs and drive them sort of to completion. And so does that mean that, you know, we need a command and control economy? Absolutely not. That's not what I'm saying at all. But is there a way that we can organize our scientific research community to be a bit more directed and a bit more thoughtful about advancing the knowledge we're building from basic to applied to developmental research? Is there a bit more emphasis that we want to give on areas that we think are strategically critical, like artificial intelligence or like new energy technology. And how do we do that, and how do we drive that forward as a society? And then the second place that I think is really critical for us to continue to push on is around our workers. At the end of the day, you know, technology has the potential to rip us apart in that it will displace jobs and create haves and have-nots, but it has the potential to move us forward as a society as well and create a great deal of wealth that we should be able to, you know, have many, many different segments of our society participate in and benefit from. And so I think we need to continue to train our people aggressively to build new programs and reconsider what it means to have sort of a lifetime learning process. And ultimately, how do we equip our workers with the skills that they need to succeed and win as we move forward through the rest of this century?
Great. That sounds great, Justin. Thank you for ending on that positive note. Thank you so much for speaking with Knowledge at Wharton.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.